The words that we read just a little while ago from Matthew chapter 25 and verses 6 through 12, especially some of the words that we read from verse 10, are among, I think, the saddest, darkest, most foreboding words that we find in all of Scripture. Very simple statement is made there at the end of verse 10 in Matthew chapter 25. It says very simply, "And the door was shut." These are words here that result in the most horrible, the most agonizing, the most painful of eternal consequences for those upon whom the door is shut or closed to. These words, of course, are part of what is very familiar to us. We recognize as the parable of the 10 virgins. We want to talk about that for a little while this evening, and especially as it relates to those words that we have in front of us this evening, "and the door was shut," the meaning of that, and some great lessons that we can learn from it. But before we begin looking at that this evening, I want us to talk about the Gospel of Matthew just very briefly, some things that we need to know, some things that we can remember about the Gospel of Matthew in which this parable is found. The Gospel of Matthew is referred to by many as one of the synoptic Gospels. That means that along with Mark and Luke, it has some very similar characteristics. And then there's John, which has some characteristics that are all of its own. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Matthew, Mark, and Luke address primarily Jesus' Galilean ministry. John addresses primarily Jesus' Judean ministry. Matthew, Mark, and Luke emphasize to a great extent Jesus' work, his teaching, his miracles among the masses, among the multitudes of people. One of the things that characterizes John's gospel and sets it apart is that it emphasizes Jesus' work, his teaching to individuals. Nicodemus in chapter 3, the Samaritan woman in chapter 4, the blind man in John 9, as well as stressing just 7 miracles in the Gospel of John. And there are a number of other characteristics or distinguishing things that would set those apart. It seems obvious that the first readers of the Gospel of Matthew were Jews. Matthew emphasizes the link between the Old and the New Testament. It emphasizes the fulfillment of prophecy, things that the Jews should have been looking for because of their familiarity with those Old Testament prophets. It emphasizes the fact of the coming of the Messiah that had been prophesied in the Old Testament. And the first verse of Matthew emphasizes that he was the son of Abraham. He was a descendant of David and the genealogy that we find there. It stresses Jesus as king and stresses his kingdom and writing relating to that. And one of the things I think it's good for us to remember is that Matthew is marked by 5 great sermons, we might say, or discourses of Jesus. The most familiar of those, of course, is the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5 through 7. The second of those involves encouragement and instructions that he gives to the apostles after we see them being chosen in the first part of Matthew chapter 10. And then in Matthew chapter 13, here's a series of some parables or some 7 parables of the kingdom. Perhaps the most familiar or notable of those is the parable of the sower, where Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like this and is like this. And he teaches great lessons here about the kingdom of heaven. Matthew chapter 18, great teaching there of Jesus on the subject of greatness, the problem of offenses or causing others to stumble, and the necessity of being willing to forgive others. And then in this setting that we're looking at this evening, Matthew chapters 23 through 25, we find another one of these great lessons or great discourses by Jesus, in which we see in chapter 23 woes that he pronounces against those unbelieving Jews, and warnings, and that emphasizes being prepared throughout that context there. You may wonder why at the end of each one of those I have just a single verse listed, especially in the first 3, and really we could have done the same thing at the end of the lesson we find in chapter 18 and chapters 23 through 25. And I'll just fill that gap in briefly for you. I may have done that in the outline. I don't recall right offhand. But at the end of each one of these lessons, of these discourses here, we find a statement similar to this in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 28. When Jesus had ended these sayings, Matthew chapter 11, and there verse 1, another very similar statement that is made, where it says, "And it came to pass when Jesus had made an end of commanding the 12 disciples," chapter 13 and verse 53, it says, and it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these parables, and so we see the beginning and we see the end of the discourse or the sermon that Jesus preaches on each one of these occasions. I'll fill in here would be that ending statement for Matthew 18 and 23 through 25. It would be chapter 19 and verse 1 for the lesson we find in Matthew 18. And it would be chapter 26 and verse 1 for the lesson that we find there in Matthew chapters 23, 24, and 25. Chapter 26 and verse 1 says, "And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples." But I want us to narrow our focus down just a little bit this evening as we continue and look at the parable of the ten virgins and the lessons that we learn from it by looking at the setting in its more immediate context. And I want us to begin by pointing out that the teaching of this parable in Matthew chapter 25, it follows a series of admonitions that Jesus gives to be watching, to be prepared, to be alert. In the latter part of Matthew chapter 23, Jesus had warned that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed because of its rejection, because of the rejection of the Jews, of Jesus himself. In Matthew 23 and there verse 36, Jesus said, "Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation." And then we see Jesus' sad entreaty over the nation or over the city of Jerusalem. And he said, "I would have gathered you together," he says. "I would have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not." And so the city was going to be punished. Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. Jesus said in the first part of Matthew chapter 24 and verse 1, there's not one stone that's going to be left on another when the things that he's talking about in the first part of this chapter take place. I want to draw, if I can, for us, just briefly in chapter 24, a line of demarcation here, where Jesus is talking about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and then moves to talking about and giving warnings and encouraging his disciples to watch for his second coming. In Matthew chapter 24 and verse 34, Jesus said there, "This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." And there are a lot of people today who look at things in Matthew chapter 24 that are written prior to that, and they fail to understand that those things have already come to pass. Jesus there was talking about things that would be a forewarning, would be a notice about the warning of or the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. So even the people could see things coming, and they could escape that destruction. But then beginning in Matthew chapter 24, and verse 35 or 36, we see here Jesus teaching about his second coming. But once again, here is a warning. It's a warning to be prepared, admonition to be watching. No one knows when Jesus is coming again, verse 36. But he said in verse 42, "Watch, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come." And then in verse 44, once again, an admonition. He says, "Therefore be ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh." And Jesus says, watch. What he's telling us to do there is to be spiritually awake, be spiritually alert, be sober-minded, be vigilant, be serious about the lives that we're living. And then following the teaching of the parable of the ten virgins, Jesus continues to admonish preparedness for his coming, preparedness for the judgment. In the parable of the talents, there in Matthew chapter 25, he in essence says, use the abilities, use the talents that you have. Put them to work because you're going to be called to give an account. And then the picture of the judgment scene in the remainder of chapter 25, where Jesus comes and all nations are gathered before him and they're separated as the shepherd will divide the sheep from the goats. And we see the eternal destinies as they are appointed there. Now go back with me, if you would, just for a few moments, and let's look at the parable of the ten virgins as we briefly sum it up by looking at some of the elements, some of the components of the account that we have here. And then we want to draw some lessons that we need today. In verse 1 of Matthew chapter 25, we see here Jesus once again introducing this parable with some familiar words. He says, then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened. And a number of times, of course, Jesus introduces his parables by saying, the kingdom of heaven is like. It's like this thing that he's about to describe. And of course, what Jesus here is doing in this parable, he's telling a story that would be something they would be familiar with, a marriage procession, a marriage feast that would be entered in. And then alongside of that, he's drawing some great spiritual lessons that all of us need. And so, as we ought to do when we look at a parable and study a parable, we ought to try to discern what the primary message of that parable is. One of the mistakes sometimes I think that people make when they study the parables is that they try to make every little detail have some kind of great spiritual significance. The truth is, generally, there's one great message, one great overriding lesson that we learn from the parables that Jesus teaches, and certainly we shouldn't try to force things that aren't there into the details of the story itself that's given. And I think when we look at the parable of the ten virgins here, the message that overrides, the message that runs throughout it is this, is that preparedness is essential. It's absolutely essential that you and I be prepared when Jesus comes again. And the thing that's stressed here is this, the time is coming when getting ready, when getting prepared will no longer be possible. Time is coming when the door will be shut, as it is here in this account. Jesus describes here these ten virgins as a word that's commonly used in other places. The Virgin Mary in Matthew 1 and verse 23. Philip had virgin daughters. Acts chapter 21 and verse 9. Paul has certain instructions regarding virgins in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 25. And other passages that we could look at. But these individuals here, these ten women, they had taken their lamps to meet the bridegroom. And this was something that would have been more familiar to those people in the first century than, of course, is to us today. But it seems that here they are, and they were under obligation. They had a responsibility to be well prepared to meet the bridegroom when he came. And when he came, then they would come together to be a part of the procession that would enter into the feast, would enter into the marriage hall or the marriage feast. And if we look at the second verse and go down through verses 3 and 4, we see that these ten virgins, they're divided into two categories, two broad categories. One consists of those five who are wise, the other those five who are foolish. Now these are those who are wise and foolish, not in the eyes of men, but in the eyes of God. And that's what makes this so important. You know, as we look at these individuals, we understand that in some respects, they were alike. They had some similarities, aside from the most obvious designation that they're given. They were alike in that they all intend to meet the bridegroom. They all intend to go into the marriage feast. They all have lamps, although there's a difference here, isn't there? And something else we see is this, that none of them know when the bridegroom will come. But they were unalike, they were dissimilar in some very significant respects. The five wise virgins are completely prepared to meet the bridegroom. The five foolish virgins are unprepared to meet the bridegroom. And I think as we see the account proceeding here, we can understand that their foolishness consisted in their lack of personal preparation, their lack of being ready when the bridegroom came. And we'll see that as the account continues here. Verse 5 tells us that the bridegroom tarried and they sleep. God's purposes and God's operations are on His own time, so to speak, although God doesn't count time as we do. You remember there were those in 2 Peter chapter 3 who were questioning the fact of the second coming. They said, where is the promise of His coming? Everything is just like it was since the fathers fell asleep. And Peter there discusses how they were just willingly ignorant of certain things. Everything had not always been the same. And in 2 Peter chapter 3, there in verses 8 and 9, the Apostle Peter offers this explanation. He says, but beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is of the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slack concerning His promise, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering to usward, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And I have no doubt whatsoever that there are a lot of people in our society today who fall into the trap of thinking, well, if Jesus is really coming again, he's not going to come anytime soon. He's not going to come in my lifetime. And thinking of that nature. And here these people were, they were mocking and they were scoffing. And so the thinking goes something like this: so I have plenty of time to do what I want to do. I have plenty of time to live for the world. I have plenty of time to, you know, engage in those things that are wrong and immoral and sinful. And then later on, I'll correct that. I'll get ready. I'm convinced there are people who think like that. You look in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 48, where here Jesus talks about an individual who he says is an evil servant, who says in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming. Here's somebody who's just convinced the Lord's coming. It's not anytime soon. And so what does he do? He begins to act in an evil way. Says, and he began to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunken. And then it says, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of. And so the bridegroom comes, they are asleep. And then at midnight, the cry is heard to meet the bridegroom. One day, the cry is going to be heard that Jesus is returning, isn't it? Paul describes that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 16. He speaks of Jesus coming with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with a trump of God. And then what we see in this account here in Matthew chapter 25 is this, in verses 7 through 9. They all arise to trim their lamps, but the lamps of the foolish virgins, it goes out. It's extinguished. And then they turn to the wise who have oil, who've made ample preparation. And they respond, we can't give you of ours. Then there won't be enough for both us and you. And they advise them, go out and seek to buy more. But then in verse 10, while they're out, the bridegroom comes. Those who are ready went in with him to the marriage. And it says then in verse 10, and the door was shut. And as a result of that, we see the position that it puts these five foolish virgins in verses 11 through 13. And it says, afterward came also the other virgins, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, verily I say you not, verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. Here's one of those Lord, Lord verses, isn't it? Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. In Luke 6 and verse 46, Jesus said there, and why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Here on this occasion, the Lord responds, I know you not. You know, Paul assures us in 2 Timothy chapter 2, 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19, that the Lord knows those who are his. The Lord knows those who are his. And because these had failed to make the proper preparation, they had failed to get ready as they should, they're left outside. And the door is shut. And it's not going to be opened to them. And so the lesson here that Jesus sets forth in verse 13 is this. He says, watch. He says, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. And that's a lesson that we need today, just as much as those people in the first century, just as much as those first hearers that Jesus addressed this lesson to. Let's think about some lessons that stand out in the parable here of the ten virgins. Some lessons that we need today. The first thing that Jesus says here in verse 13 is this. He says, watch. And we've already made reference to the fact that when Jesus says watch, he's saying you be vigilant, you be alert, you be ready, you be spiritually sober-minded. You know, there are just a series of things that the Word of God tells us that we need to be watchful unto, that we need to be alert to, that we need to be vigilant to. One of those is false teachers. The Apostle Paul writing, or speaking rather, in Luke recording, I should say, in Acts chapter 20, Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, he's warning the elders from the church at Ephesus by saying this, take heed therefore unto yourselves, and to all the flock over which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers, to feed the church of God which he hath purchased with his own blood. And he talks about how men will arise speaking perverse things. He talks about how there'll be those who will seek to lead the flock astray from both the outside and from among its own self. And then in verse 31 he says, therefore watch, be alert, be vigilant. You and I are told that we need to watch that we enter not into temptation. The devil is always on the warpath. The devil is always seeking to do those things, to present temptation in such a way that we reach out and we grasp it and we lose our souls. Jesus in Matthew chapter 26, there in verse 41, he tells those three men who went into the garden with him when he went to pray. He says, watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Those are the words of Jesus to Peter, James, and John who accompanied him there into the garden of Gethsemane. We need to watch that we enter not into temptation because we have an adversary who is ever on the prowl. Peter really describes him in such terms as that in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. When he says, there be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil as a roaring lion walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. What do we learn here? What we learn here if we watch and guard against temptation is this. We don't see how close we can get to sinful situations, to places we shouldn't go, to people who are going to be a source of temptation to us. We avoid. We flee. We don't trifle with it. We look for a way of escape. We're to be watchful, alert in prayer. That's what Paul says in Colossians chapter 4 and there verse 2. Colossians the 4th chapter. And there the 2nd verse. The apostle says, continue in prayer and watch in the same with thanksgiving. We're to watch. We're to be concerned about the spiritual well-being of others. You remember in Ezekiel chapter 3, here in an Old Testament passage, that the Lord in speaking to the prophet Ezekiel said this. He said, son of man, this is Ezekiel 3 and verse 17, he said, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word of my mouth and give them warning from me. We won't read all of those words there, but what he says is this. He says, when I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, now givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity. But his blood will I require at thine hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity. But thou hast delivered thy soul. We learn in New Testament text, Galatians 6, for example, verses 1 and 2, that those who are spiritual are to seek to restore those who have erred, who have gone astray. James chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. James writes there, brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, and shall hide a multitude of sins. But we want to go back, and we want to address the immediate subject that Jesus has at hand here, and that's this. He's saying, you watch in view of the fact that I'm coming again. That's what Jesus is saying here. He's saying, you be alert. Jesus said in John chapter 14, there in verses 1 through 3, as he spoke to the apostles shortly before his betrayal, he said, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. So many texts that stress the fact that Jesus is coming again. Those angels who stood by in white apparel as Jesus ascended into heaven said, why are you gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus which is taken up from you shall return in like manner. Acts chapter 1, verse 11. That context there. But no one knows. You know, throughout the years, throughout the decades, even the centuries, there have been those who have been date setters, especially in the mid-1800s. I mean, like William Miller and others. And they would set one date, and of course Jesus wouldn't come, and they would alter it just a little bit, and set the date again, and Jesus wouldn't come, and it seemed like people never learned. Hal Lindsey, of more recent vintage, beginning back in the 70s, basically predicting that Jesus would come within a range of some 10 years or so. That's back in the 70s. But what we learn is this: no one knows when Jesus will return. In Matthew chapter 24 and there verse 36, Jesus said this. He said, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only." What else do we learn from the parable of the virgins here? One of the things we learn is this, and that's the preparation that one individual makes is not transferable to another. I guess another way, maybe a simpler way to say that is simply this. When we stand before God in judgment, we're going to stand there as individuals. Not as families, not as groups, not even as pairs, as a husband and wife or brother and sister, not as a congregation, but as individuals. We're not saved by our associations. Matthew chapter 25 and verse 9. There once again, the wise answered saying, "Not so. We can't give you of our oil. Our preparation can't be somehow transferred to your good, to your profit, for your benefit." Not so. He said, "Lest there not be enough for us and you. But you go rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves." Paul put it this way in Romans chapter 14 and verse 12. Romans chapter 14 and there verse 12. He said, "So then every one of us shall give account of himself unto God." And then here's the lesson that we emphasize with the title of the lesson, and that's this. One day the door will be shut. By now, for those who need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, the door is open. There's time. There's opportunity. All things are ready, so to speak, as we sometimes sing. You have a good mind. You know what to do. And again, there's opportunity. But one day that door will be closed. One day that opportunity will cease. Jesus said in John chapter 9 and verse 4, "I must work the works of Him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work." For those who maybe once obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, but have gone astray, whose lives have become short of what they ought to be, who aren't faithful, who aren't steadfast, maybe who have lapsed into some kind of sin, there's opportunity. The door's open to make the correction that you need to make in your life. But one thing that we learn here again is this: one day the door is going to be shut, and after that, it's going to be too late. You know, we learn there are several things that can close that door. One of those things that will certainly close that door is death. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27. There the Hebrew writer makes this observation. He says, "And as it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment." All of us are going to die one day, unless we happen to still be alive when Jesus comes again. And that's the second thing that we're going to address here. But that's still going to close that door of opportunity, isn't it? The second coming of Jesus Christ, when He comes again. It's not going to be time then to make preparation, just as we learn here in this parable. The day that it's going to be then is the day of judgment. We're going to stand before Him and give an account. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, beginning there in verse 51, the Apostle Paul said, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep." As everyone's not going to die. There'll be some who are alive, obviously, when Jesus comes again. But he says, "But we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed." But you know, there's something else that can close that door of opportunity. And that's something that an individual, in essence, does to themselves. And that is, they can harden their own conscience. They can turn their own thoughts against God and against the Scriptures to such a degree that it becomes so difficult to reach that person anymore. 1 Timothy chapter 4. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and there verse 2. Here the Apostle Paul is speaking of some of these false teachers, and he describes them with these words. He says, "Speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron." I've heard that illustrated in different ways. Did you ever go through a time maybe when you would set your alarm clock And the alarm clock would go off. Maybe you'd reach over and, you know, slap the snooze button. And you just repeatedly do that. And I've heard of people who would do that to the point that they get where they wouldn't even hear their alarm clock anymore. They would ignore it, and they would ignore it, and it would go off, and the time would come when it just wouldn't even register anymore. Maybe something that we can relate to is you work with some kind of tool in your hand. Maybe a hammer, maybe a hoe, something that you have a grasp of. And when you begin to do that at first, maybe your hand isn't tough and calloused to a certain point yet. And what happens? When you're beginning to work with that tool, you develop blisters. You feel it. But you continue to work with it over and over and over again, and it callouses over, doesn't it? And you don't feel it anymore. People can become like that with the gospel of Christ. They hear it, and it touches their heart to a certain extent. They hear it again, and it has an effect. And they hear it again. But a person can hear it to such a point that it begins not to have the same effect. Heard of people perhaps who would hear the gospel of Christ, and you know, they would just practically hold on to the front of the pew. It seemed to keep themselves back from obeying the gospel of Christ. And they'd reject it and reject it and reject it again, and finally it didn't seem to faze them anymore. The point is, there's a danger of hardening our own conscience where the word doesn't prick our hearts as maybe it once did. These things can close that door of opportunity. Death is coming. Jesus is coming. And there's the danger of rejecting the gospel over and over again till we harden our own conscience. There's no second chance once that door is shut. You see this sad scene of these five foolish virgins as they're outside of the door. They're knocking. They're beseeching the Lord to let them in. And what does He say? He says, "I say unto you, I know you not." Not another opportunity, but "I know you not." You know, Luke chapter 16 and verses 19 through 31. We see the picture there where in this account of the rich man and Lazarus, both of them die. Both of them are in the Hadean realm, as we might describe it. They're in different parts of that. And there's a great gulf in between the rich man and Lazarus. You recall that account. The rich man is suffering terribly in torment. To where it would have been relief for Lazarus just to dip the tip of his finger in water and place that on his tongue. He said, "I'm tormented in this flame." But what does Abraham say to him? He says, "There's a great gulf fixed, so that one could not change their state after death." The rich man had no chance to be saved after death. And Lazarus was in a place of comfort, Abraham's bosom. He wasn't going to be lost. Neither one of them were going to change their state after their death. And so then, as we think about this lesson, and as we bring it to a conclusion, and we think about the things that we need to learn from the parable of the 10 virgins, just as those 10 individuals fell into 2 categories when the bridegroom came, when Jesus comes again, every single individual who's ever lived is going to fall into one of 2 categories, either wise or you're foolish. Another way to say that you're going to be found as either being saved or being lost when Jesus comes again. You're going to be found as one who entered the straight gate and walked the narrow way that leads to life, or one who entered the wide gate and walked the broad way that leads to destruction. The obvious question for every one of us here this evening is this: what category would I fall into if Jesus were to come right now? If He were to come tonight, would I be found as those 5 wise individuals or those 5 foolish individuals? Once again, the foolish, they knew that the Lord was coming, but they were unprepared. Those who are going to be found foolish when Jesus comes again are those who fail to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Maybe those who once obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, but who fail to order their priorities as they should. Who allow the things of this world to preoccupy their minds to where spiritual things are completely pushed to the background, they're just drowned out. They're choked by the cares and riches and the things of this life. Those who are foolish are those who fail to grow in the grace and knowledge of the Lord, as Peter writes in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 18, who fail to remain faithful and steadfast in their own lives. What about those who are wise? Well, if we're among those who are found to be wise when Jesus comes again, then it means we're diligently making preparation. We're growing in grace and we're growing in knowledge. We know what's to come. As one day time is going to end, this physical universe is going to be destroyed, and it's not going to matter how much we had, how big it was, how new it was, or anything else from a material standpoint, but simply, are we ready for that great day? We know what's to come, and we're looking for it accordingly and making preparation. And the wise will love His appearing, look forward to the appearing, to the coming of Jesus Christ. Even as Paul writes in 2 Timothy chapter 4, 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning there in verse 6 and going through verse 8. And he made this statement there. He said, "For I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. And not to me only, but unto all them also that love His appearing." Are you ready this evening for the time that the bridegroom will come, when Jesus will return, time will end, and we'll all stand before Him in judgment? If you're here and you're not, well, the door's still open. That's the good news. The door's still open. You can still obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's time and opportunity of coming to Him as a penitent believer, confessing your faith in Jesus as the Son of God, by being baptized in water for the remission of your sins, being raised to walk in a new life. Or if you're here this evening and one who recognizes that as a Christian your life isn't what it ought to be and you need to make correction in that, the door's still open at this point. There's time, there's opportunity, and you can do that even this evening. If it be the case, either one of us, won't you come as we stand and sing?